Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest podcast. Now, this is a Talal initiated podcast. We were, I was round at Talal's house the other day. Yeah, we hang out.
Yeah, we do.
As well as do podcasts together where.
Yeah, we were playing craps against the wall.
Smoking cigars. We're actually round at your sister's house. Yeah. And we were talking about how this podcast had taken a swerve, not before time, into discussing issues around Palestine. And your sister, I think, or both of you, suggested we should have Adam on, who's a family friend.
Someone me and my sister both follow online. Me and my sister both obviously very passionate about freedom for Palestine and the whole movement. And so when we see really great coverage and passionate discourse about it online, we always look up who's talking. And Adam Broomberg is one of those people who basically is fearless and has been to Palestine many times and takes a really good camera with him. He's a visual artist, a photographer, and he does great coverage and candid video capture out there and spends time with Palestinians and kind of documents their experience from their point of view in a way that you don't see very often. So yeah, me and my sister love this guy's feed, and she suggested at our dinner that we get him on.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, hi, Adam.
Hello.
He's here now. And well, yeah, it's like you, as you suggested before we started recording, we should just jump right in. So let's jump right in and you tell us your story, really, I suppose.
Well, maybe just to also... slightly complicated. Well, describe my particular minestrone that makes me up, which gives me a very particular podium from which to speak about these issues, which is first, I come from a Holocaust surviving family on both sides, Lithuanian Ashkenazi Jews who managed to just sneak in or sneak out of that region in the 30s. I don't think there was much of a choice, but they didn't win the lottery because they landed up in South Africa.
Right.
Which so I grew up, I was born in 1970 into an apartheid South Africa. So here you have, Jewish family, member of a big Jewish community. There were 250,000 odd Jews who came out of there. And my parents, for some odd reason, sent me to a Jewish religious Zionist school from the age of six. So,
whoa.
I mean, imagine this. Just close your eyes and imagine it's 1985. You're a 15-year-old. It's like that's a rough time for anybody, right? And somebody asked you to describe your identity, and you are a white heterosexual cis Zionist Jewish man. Could you have a worse possible pickup line? So, But I was fortunate enough to have been a terrible mistake 7 years after what my parents had determined was their last child. So I had three older siblings who were politically engaged and got me involved in the anti-apartheid struggle at the age of 15. And you realize, going to this Zionist school, I was being fed the lines of, Israel being a land without people for a people without land, that the Jews were making the desert bloom, my grandmother having such firsthand experience of the Holocaust and, visibly traumatized from it, although I think this stuff passes down.
But, absolutely.
It's interesting to think about language. I grew up in a house that spoke, these toxic fights between my mother and my grandmother in Yiddish, right? And I don't know, Alexei, if you speak any Yiddish or you
a few words really. My mother was grew up in an entirely Yiddish speaking household, but she didn't really pass on.
Right.
I find myself strangely using more Yiddish words in the last few years. I don't quite know why then, but I'll say, you know, what's this mishigas, and you know,
yeah, that's
sort of words like that, you know, but apart from that, I don't really know anything.
I think that's called senility. You're losing it.
I'm reverting to it, yeah. Yeah.
But my mother was never called by her name. My grandmother called her Stickfleisch mit zwei Augen, which is a piece of meat with two eyes. And
okay.
And but the reason I'm talking about it is so at home there was Yiddish. At school, the two languages I was taught as my two second languages were Hebrew and Afrikaans. I mean, can you imagine, like, the two worst languages of oppression on the planet, right? These are my two second languages, right? But the kind of the bright side of the story is that at 15, when suddenly the kind of, because we were being told the same thing at school about apartheid system in South Africa, is that if this ended, that would be the demise of white people in South Africa. The minute that infrastructure and, you know, and set of laws ended, that was the end of us, right? So the minute the kind of ideological narrative of apartheid started to kind of collapse around me, I found the same started happening to me in these Jewish studies classes, where I was being fed very similar succinct lines about the reason why the state of Israel is our savior.
So, because a lot of Jews were also involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, weren't they? The Slovos and so on. So your parents weren't part of that.
Well, you say a lot. I was in Rwanda very shortly after the genocide, and I met this remarkable woman called Reva Adler. And Reva explained, she was interviewing the Hutu perpetrators, and she said to me, survivors of genocide have, when they encounter injustice, they have one of two responses. About 99% of them hide under the table because they're so afraid of power and what power can do. Less than 1% will stand up on the table, but that 1% will scream bloody murder. And those are the Joe Slovos, and those are the Sydney Kentridges, and those are the progressives that we know, you know. But to be honest, and this is really important, is that, you know, my family went from bottom feeders as Jews, you know, who were. Like that Woody Allen joke. Do you remember in Annie Hall where he says to Annie Hall, where did you get that tennis racket? And she said, oh, it was a gift from my grandmother. And he said, oh, my grandmother was too busy getting raped by Cossacks to give me birthday presents. But I don't know how I got diverted into that. And we probably shouldn't mention Woody Allen anyway. But what I'm trying to say is
that's another question, isn't it? That's a whole other debate about,
what I'm trying to say is my parents, they really enjoyed the change of identity from being Jews to being white.
Yes.
And I'd say about 249,000 out of the 250,000 Jews who arrived on those shores took full advantage of the utter corruption that was apartheid, and the access to the immense wealth that corruption offered, given the mineral and wealth of that country.
But your brothers were politically engaged. I mean,
I've got two brothers and a sister who were. Yeah. Well, the two brothers were politically engaged. I've got a sister who lives in Israel, so that further complicates stuff, right?
So, Christmas must be a terrible time. Apart from the fact that you don't celebrate it.
No, I mean, we just buried my mother 3 weeks ago. And I've got to say something. So she lived in London. We all live on different continents because of the sheer force of my mother's personality. It kind of, it blew us apart. But we came together and it was very beautiful. We've all grown up and forgiven one another. But it is difficult doing what I do, which is spend maybe every second month in Hebron in Palestine, running an NGO with a very well-known Palestinian activist called Issa Amro, and sending, you know, firsthand, not written things and not particularly incisive, just firsthand visual reports of what's going on. And that's very confrontational for her and her family. Her husband fought in Shatila in Lebanon.
Your sister?
My sister's husband. And my nephew was in the special forces. So last May, he was involved in, you know, when they went into Gaza. So this is not easy stuff to navigate, but somehow we managed. And I want to emphasize that, you know, if we can manage to kind of maintain the love and be able to talk these things through, you know, it's not exactly Camp David, but we do it.
Yeah. Well, that's a remarkable lesson, also a remarkable. I think what you're saying is that there's also the implication of what you're saying is also that those attempts to shut down precisely the kind of debate that you and your family engage in are wrong, really.
What would the outcome be? I would lose a sister.
Right.
And so I think if we take that as a metaphor for the Jewish community at large, it's like shutting these debates down means we lose each other.
Mm. Right. Yeah, that's a very powerful point, I think. I guess we got to return to how you came to be where you are now. What was that kind of journey? I hate using journey, but I find myself using it frequently.
It sounds different when Russell Brand says it than you do it, thank God.
That's very kind.
I don't know what – my journey is an odd one. So I left South Africa just – there was still apartheid, there was still conscription. I then landed up for about 6 months living in a squat on Dalston Lane, and then somehow...
Have you been back there recently?
I'll get to that, yeah.
Right. Changed a lot.
Then the next kind of decade was in Italy, and what happened is I watched Italy get taken over by Berlusconi and Lega Nord, and, you know, he bought up all the media. And you watched the kind of, I mean, Italian cinema was still being made before he came in. And then, like, the media degraded to, like, these Botoxed one-line, you know, revolt. Basically, the kind of populist language that then happened. So I left there, went to England, and then stayed there 15 years until something called Brexit came along.
And it's your fault. Everywhere you move, it gets worse.
Yeah.
I think it's a fungus that I carry. the neoliberal fascist fungus.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I literally, it was 2 days after the referendum, and I had an exhibition here and asked the people at the table, how difficult would it be to find a place for 2 kids in a school and an apartment? And we moved 2 weeks later with 3 bags and we haven't left.
But that's where you are now.
Yeah, in Berlin.
Which is Berlin, right, yeah.
But that's not the end of the story. And I've got to say, Berlin's been very, very generous and kind. It's been, it's a very forgiving place. It's got a sense of community and social responsibility, and, you know. But I mentioned my mother passing away, and I was kind of cut off from all kinds of media. And I got back to Berlin and to these kind of panic messages from people I really respect who wouldn't necessarily alarm me, saying, Adam, you need to respond to these allegations that are in Die Zeit, in Taz, in basically in every newspaper in Germany, which came from a person who occupies a position in the Senate called the Commissioner of Anti-Semitism. And he called me in these numerous publications, in summary, a hateful anti-Semite who is boycotting, advocates for boycotting Israel, and does not stop at suggesting terrorism against Jews.
Okay. Is this person Jewish themselves, or are they?
Well, he converted very recently.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you imagine? Can you fucking imagine?
Okay, so I mean, obviously, you know, my first instinct is, do you think you can convert into a lineage of trauma this long and this deep? I said, I didn't want to ask him. Well, I would like to see his penis, actually. But anyway, what I want to do is avoid this becoming a kind of provincial conversation about a petty bourgeois bureaucrat and me. You know, we're talking about much bigger stuff here, and I think that's the opportunity. Is that these very heavy libelous remarks? Because at this point in time, Germany understands me as an anti-Semitic terrorist.
Right.
Today is the first time that I will have had the right to reply. There's an interview in Die Zeit, which is where he was interviewed a few weeks ago, and in Berliner Zeitung coming out both today, where I was given for the first chance a right of reply. You know, I've been muzzled.
And you've already done the interview?
Yeah, yeah.
But it hasn't been published yet, so you don't know what they're keeping in
or how much they'll edit it. No, I did it on condition that I could see the final version, because I don't trust them.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, what have you done that specifically that provoked these allegations?
I'm an artist. I use photography. I was a professor of art in Hamburg University for the last 6 years. All my work is around human rights issues. So not only Palestine, though in 2004, along with my former work partner, we did a book with someone called Eyal Weitzman, who is one of the kind of strong Israeli kind of voices of the left, or former Israeli. And this book really analyzed and picked apart how Israel uses particular visual strategies to communicate its narrative. For instance, this idea of making the desert bloom. We worked with the head of Bezalel Architectural School, whose PhD was to superimpose all those forests, you see, the pine forests, over the 500-odd destroyed Arab villages from 1948. And there was a clear correspondence. And that is a strategy that was well practiced by the Poles and the Germans. So the Zionists learned that trick, because within 10 minutes after planting a pine forest, it looks like it's been there since the Jurassic period.
Right.
And the rocks look like they've been there since Jesus was there. You know, they're not evidence of a crime.
No.
So, we exhibited this in New York at the time, around 2005, and there's a character called Ronald Lauder, you know, of the Estee Lauder family, who... is immensely powerful. He was once known for paying the most money for a painting ever, and it was bought on auction and it started at a relatively low price. And he bid against one other person till it reached the highest ever figure paid. And you know who that other person was? His brother. I think that says everything about the guy you want to know. Apart from the fact that, unlike his mother, who struggled with her identity as a Jew, he's taken on his Jewish identity as a protector of the state of Israel, and that is his kind of monolithic idea of what it means to be a Jew. And he accused us, or the museum, of accusing Israel of ethnic cleansing. Right. And so I found myself in a court case with Ronald Lauder and his Estee Lauder billions. And I really haven't had a career in America since. Not that I regret it.
You do pay a price, though, don't you, for advocating for Palestine? I mean, I think that's one of the things
At this. I've been warned not to go to any public events.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty uninformed about Germany, but my sense is, from the other things I read, that in the last few years, Germany has become much more repressive towards, because Berlin has actually got the largest Palestinian population in certainly in Germany. But the authorities in Germany have bought in very enthusiastically to the idea of the new anti-Semitism and left anti-Semitism and all crap, you know.
I think that's a bit like saying, Israel's government's getting much more fascist. I mean, it's like it's incremental, but it's basically been the same line, you know.
Really?
Ben-Gurion, if you had to read the statements of Ben-Gurion, he was like, we've got to get these people out of here. You know, it's like they were much more right-wing than Ben-Gavir or Netanyahu or whatever. I mean, this government's just, they're just being more honest and they're less savvy about dealing with the press. That's all. They're just like.
Well, who are we talking about, Germany or Israel?
No. Both.
Right.
But yeah, about Israel. And I think Germany's always had the staunch line this is the confusion for me, and this is the crux of it, really. And this is what I tried to get across in my response, which is, what did we learn from the Shoah? What did we learn from the Holocaust, right? There's two possible routes we could take. We could say, we have to, by all means necessary, protect the rights of human beings, especially the most vulnerable. Because at that point in time, the Jews, the homosexuals, the Roma, were disabled. The most vulnerable.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah. The other route, and this is where I this is the problem I have with this other route, which is that what we need to do to protect the safety of Jews is to protect the nation state of Israel at all costs, unconditionally. And now my argument is nation states do not have rights. Yes. Nation states are meant to guarantee the rights of the people that live within them and not at the expense of people who do not live within them. And what we're doing is we are unconditionally supporting a state that is very visibly denying the human rights of the most vulnerable people, acting with full impunity and against international law. And is this the lesson we're taking from the Shoah? That's what I want to say to the German government.
Well, yeah. Well, it is, isn't it, really? I mean, they are kind of thing. Anyway, so my cat, Wilf, is...
I thought I heard Wilf
trying
earlier.
To add to the discussion. Yeah, yeah.
What's Wilf's
what side's your cat on?
He's, I don't know, he's pretty, cat's... Cats are.
I gotta get a screenshot of that. Oh, you've
self-interested.
I mean, cats are beholden to no one. They're a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little bit like the UAE. You know, it's like.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking in Animal Farm. You know, the cat I think represents the lumpen proletariat really, and he joins in the revolution, the animals' revolution, at the last minute, but is essentially self-interested. Really, I think that's Cat's kind of political position, really. And so, I think I tried to model myself on the cat in Animal Farm to a degree.
Well, you haven't done very well.
Every few years, you get this sense that things are changing. Oh my God, people are talking about Palestine in a new way. Oh my God, people are starting to wake up and something's going to change. And then it completely fades away, that feeling. And then it comes back. And I think we're going through that again at the moment.
Well, I wouldn't say, I think that it's, yeah, you felt, I'm quite optimistic, at the start of BDS in the early 2000s. And you definitely sensed, that people were, I think any decent person really, I think any decent person thinks there's something wrong with Israel, really, if they know the truth. But then I think massive action is taken to counteract that.
Yeah.
You think of the extraordinary lies and the extraordinary energy that's taken to discrediting BDS, boycott, divestments and sanctions, an entirely non-violent protest movement.
Yeah.
And the hateful rhetoric that is directed towards those who support it, like Adam, is extraordinary in its ferocity, because I think the people who support Israeli apartheid know in a way that if the truth gets out, then if people are allowed to see the reality, if they're allowed to protest peacefully, then they're in trouble. I don't know what you feel about that, Adam.
I mean, I grew up in South Africa. I was a student in the late 80s. That was the height of the struggle. So
yeah.
if we don't, I think one of the problems is like BDS has become like people, you'll speak to many people who don't even know what it stands for, boycott, divest, sanctions. It's like the RFD in Germany. You just know it's like these are right-wing fucking Nazis, right? Sanctions, there was no moral awakening suddenly in the late 80s in South Africa. Thatcher and Reagan were massive supporters of apartheid.
Mm.
What happened is... the moral compass turned towards the country, massive, the banks and industry and culture agreed upon a process of sanction and divestment. And in the late 80s, the government was absolutely broke and had no choice but to sit down like mensches and negotiate with the ANC.
Yes.
And when, like you said, let's not even call it BDS, let's call it boycott, divestment and sanction, because it's not a movement, it's a strategy. And it's a strategy that was suggested during the Second Intifada as a peaceful means of resistance. And
absolutely,
the Second Intifada
yeah.
was very violent. So I agree with you. And then this place is worse because in 2019, they tried to make it, in the Bundestag, they tried to make it, first of all, a hate crime, making it anti-Semitic. Now, it was challenged and it was found to be unconstitutional, but the echoes of that attempt have leaked out.
Mm,
and
yes.
There was an atmosphere in Germany that BDS is illegal, right?
Yes.
And it's not.
I think that kind of exists here as well. That feeling.
Right. I just think... I made these hoodies that says like BDS is my kink. it works well in Berlin, I got to say.
So what's the attempts that have been made to censor me have been incredibly mild, really. And I had tremendous support. So I have got involved in the odd hoo-ha, not connected with, nothing to do with anti-apartheid stuff, but I remember it made me feel terrible, really. I mean, just to have yourself misrepresented so virulently. I don't know. How do you feel about this? What's going on with your life at the moment? And where you think what's going to happen, really?
I feel, I'm not sure whether it's more testimony to a life of absolute privilege as a white man. You know, I walked for 52 years feeling very safe through incredibly unsafe places in this world. And you know, that's mostly testimony to my skin color and my privilege. But I've got to say that I feel scared of going out into the street in Germany now.
Yeah.
And as a Jew, having just buried my mother, who had such fresh kind of trauma around the Holocaust, to be back here and to see this kind of rise of this fierce kind of fascist thing, which I've been running away from my whole life, you know, in the form of apartheid, in the form of Berlusconi's like Northern League, and then Brexit, which, you know, and the anti-Semitism that was also embedded in Brexit. I mean, look at that book that Boris Johnson wrote.
Yes,
I could smell the fascism in the air when they started speaking about that referendum, and then now to be in Germany and feel like fuck, where? Because you know, if I had to try and get a professorship here, I mean, that's what I do. That's how I feed my children. I teach. I cannot do it because, as a professor, you're also part of you're a civil servant.
Right.
So not only my livelihood, but also my sense of well-being and security feels very compromised. I will feel relieved when these various interviews come out, hopefully this evening or whenever they do, because to feel muzzled, to be able to not to respond to these like vicious accusations is an awful feeling.
So he just made accusations in the paper, or using his official position, he has also taken action against you in other ways as well.
I mean, being called, having committed hate crime in the form of anti-Semitism and advocating for terrorism against Jews, those are not light allegations to be made by a member of Senate.
Right.
And so that's plenty. And he's done it in, you know, 10 or more publications. But the thing is, I know, you know, but and I need to say this, my fight's not against this nebbish, you know, this little schmick. It's and also my fight is not, I'm not here to change the psyche of Germany or point out how they've kind of, in psychoanalytical terms, like the split that's happened, which has made them not deal with the Holocaust where they think they are, right?
Yes.
That's not my mission. My mission is, and this is going to sound really odd, but you've heard of the term the right of return.
Yes.
I would like the right of return because, you know, if you said to me, where would you want to go next, Adam? I would like to go next to a place, let's call it Israel-Palestine, or let's call it a place that is a democratic space where it respects universal human rights, regardless of their religion, their ethnicity.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing?
And that I want that right of return.
Yes, yes, I agree. That would be... you know, that would be such a beautiful dream, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I've been noticing on YouTube, you know, you get the YouTube adverts before you watch your video that you've clicked on. And there's a really big push of these holidays in Tel Aviv adverts. Yes. And they've got these two, it begins with these two like incredibly young, trendy cool kids, yeah, and like the a boy and a girl, and the girl has like rainbow dyed hair, and she starts the advert by going, "Hey yo, you want to go to a holiday where it's fun, vibrant, modern, and hip and cool?" And then she's doing like some breakdancing on a rock, and then it's like, "Come to Tel Aviv, there's beaches, and it's modern and liberal and all that." And they're like, and the whole time I'm thinking, you've just put it in words that I was feeling, like. I'm like, how can you like consider that a holiday, knowing the political backdrop of where you're going? Who would go on a relaxing holiday to a place that has such weight in the air, you know, of this? And they really,
well, a lot of people, because they don't know, do they? You know, the truth is kept from them.
You know, I was talking to Talal just before you came on here, and I was saying, you know, I had the psychiatrist stroke psychoanalyst who was in Vienna for a while. It was a remarkable guy, and he I hate this word diagnosis, but he said you've got something that we call proto suicide, right? He said you willingly put yourself in the line of danger.
Yes.
And he wasn't talking about it in a noble way. He wasn't saying like it's your moral compass that does that. He was questioning it. But let's not go into the drives behind it. Let's just face that I do have it, and luckily most of the time I use it for political causes as opposed for literally just standing in front of a train. So I've been spending more and more time in Hebron, and Hebron is the reason why Hebron is because, you know, Ramallah is full of cultural kind of programs, artist residencies. Bethlehem has a few. Hebron is a wasteland. But you spend 10 minutes, 15 minutes in Hebron, and you get the notion of apartheid, occupation, and Jewish supremacy. You get it, and nobody has to utter the words because, you know, me as a Jew, Isa as a Palestinian, we have to take separate roads to his house, right?
Right.
Isa is subject to military law, whereas me as a Jew, I'm subject to normal civil law of the State of Israel. I mean, I could go on, but I just want to say one thing is that the last time I was there was about 6 weeks ago, and I was saying to Talal, I've been to dangerous places, you know, as like a so-called like documentary photographer in the beginning of my, I went to, you know, like maximum security jails with 30,000 people, or, you know, I went to Afghanistan in 2003 and like Iraq 2005, like some kind of macho hero or whatever. But the two times I felt most existentially, physically, and really at threat of death was in Hebron about 2 months ago, where we went there to take pictures of olive trees. You know, the olive trees in that area are between 2,000 and then up to 4,000 years old, right?
Mm-hmm. And a tree can be that old.
Oh, 4,500 years old, there's one. Think about the change of power that those trees have seen from the Ottomans to the
Romans,
the Crusaders since 1967 the settlers have destroyed 1 million of these trees.
Yes. So
part of our project is to focus on how to preserve and protect these trees, and so we were there. On one of my first visits, we saw smoke coming from one of the trees down below, and we ran there. And what they do is they pour gasoline down the center of these giant trunks. So by the time you see the smoke, essentially the tree's dead. And I think this project speaks beautifully to anyone, including my late mother, who was like a diehard Zionist, because who on earth who felt a genuine attachment to a land, who felt a biblical right to that land, who felt a love of it, right, as a sanctified space, who would destroy its oldest indigenous citizen? That's not a person who loves that land. That's a person who's driven by hate. And the reason is because the olive tree is of totemic importance to the Palestinians, but also it's an immensely important crop, right? It delivers, mm-hmm. its yield is huge. So to cut a long story short, I was there with this 8x10 giant camera, you know, slowly taking a picture. And then what happens is the settlers, the Jewish settlers in Hebron, they send these packs of kids. You were talking about the Lord of the Flies. Try like 100 kids, right? Ranging from the age of 5 to 17, dressed in their yarmulkes and tzitzit, full kind of religious garb, with sticks, metal sticks, wooden sticks, stones, right? And they are accompanied by members of the IOF, the Israeli military. And basically we kept on getting attacked by these kids. And I've just had just enough training to know that you cannot lift a finger because they're minors. So if I so much as push back, I would, if I was Palestinian and I pushed back, I'd be shot on the spot. The fact that I'm Jewish, I'd be removed, right? The work would be over or I'd be whatever. So, but I got pretty badly beaten, and there's footage of it, right? Several times. And a few days later, I returned to Berlin, and it happened to be the anniversary of Kristallnacht, which is known, you know, widely known as the kind of beginning of the Holocaust, essentially, in mm-hmm. Berlin. And the memorials held on the site of these two, the oldest synagogues that were burned down. Now, I arrived there with a crew who, you know, we made these posters, Jews against fascism everywhere. This guy comes up to me, and big guy. I mean, I'm a short Jew, you know. this is a fucking tall Jew and big. And he comes up to me, like looking down at me, and he's like, get rid of those signs. And I'm like, I said, what's going on? He said, who gave you the right to be here? I said, the death of 90% of my family at the hands of this country. I think that's Charlie's like golden ticket, if you ask me, right? Mm-hmm. And then he said, get rid of the sign. I said, hang on, let's break this down. What troubles you about the sign? Because it says, Jews against fascism everywhere. I said, are you anti-Semitic? He said, no, I'm a Jew. I said, are you a fascist? He said, no, you know. I said, so the word everywhere bothers you. And I said, can I ask you something? Have you got this kind of like weird synesthesia thing where you read everywhere and it says Israel? Do you think I'm applying that there's the possibility that Israel could also have fascist traits? At which point he started attacking me, at which point I ran because, you know, I may be proto-suicidal, but I don't have courage. You know where I sought refuge is with the fucking German police. And now the irony of a Jew being like feeling that his life's threatened by another Jew and is seeking protection from the German police. It's just, this has been the most surreal trip of my life.
How have your friends been? How's it been? Have you felt a lot of support from those around you?
That's a good question. First of all, my kids are young, so I've tried to keep as much of this from them as possible. Really, but it has revealed some of whom I have assumed were friends and allies have disappeared.
Yes, that's kind of what I was in. Yeah.
And
is that one of the things that's one of the prices they make you pay that, you know, it's very difficult to deal with, I think.
Because these people, you know, by association, their livelihoods or safety is also would be threatened. And but so it's been, I've got to say, I mean, but those who do stick by you are like hard and fast. So at the same time, and I've got like lovely messages from people abroad, you know what I mean? Like amazing. But it's quite easy to send a message on WhatsApp, you know, or like, that is meaningful, honestly. It's like amazing.
And sometimes, I don't know, but sometimes people you wouldn't expect to be supportive of mentors, as it were, are, you know. I don't know if you found that as well, really.
I actually really have found that. And But it does feel a bit lonely and alienating, and it's like, you know, there's snow out on the street, and it's like, it's the weirdest thing. So it's like, I've just, every time I've got second thoughts, like,
Well, you want to go out outside, and play, you know, like, play in the snow.
Yeah, I want to play in the snow.
I mean, how do you think it'll go from here?
I mean, I think let's see how this man responds to my response, because whereas his were like these baseless, very libelous accusations, I picked apart all his statements in a very legal and juridical, logical way. There was nothing personal. I don't think he's the sharpest blade in the drawer, and I think if he was smart, he would apologize and he would retract it. The last thing that I really want, I've consulted very top lawyers who've said this is there's definitely a libel case. I mean, this is like, you know, but they said we would do anything in our power not to put you through a German court case with the government. Like, they will go through your life with a fine tooth comb, and it's like, do you want to spend a year in the public eye? And do you, and like, I've also, you know, it's like, I'm a bit of an oddball, you know, like, if somebody's going to go through 52 years of my life with a particular lens, you know what I mean? They could narrate that life in a whole different way than it was
intended. Absolutely, yeah. You know? And if they look at you in a malevolent, I mean, they can do that with anybody. I mean, that's another.
But then, I mean, you know, where to next? In 2006,
will they let you back into? Do you think the Israelis will let you back into? They've been letting you in so far, haven't they? Surprising,
but I think you know what the Israelis are very good at doing is not kicking up a fuss until the activities of a person are actually enough of a threat, because they don't want to draw attention to it.
Right.
Yeah. But so in terms of actions, what I'm doing is also like organizing people. Like, I'm talking to like Cat Power, you know, the musician. I don't want to mention it all. It just like sounds like name dropping, but a bunch of people who you know, because we would come for 5 days, and we're organizing a series of trips, and within that 5 days, maybe they can play in a small venue if they're a musician, or a writer can do a reading, or under no duress to do anything, but just, I think it's really important to show people who do have a kind of big influence the reality on the ground, because it's like, you know what, all of this talk is unnecessary when you're there. It's like,
Have you got any other stories of your experiences in Hebron or wider Palestine that you might share with us? Because I think that is the important thing to talk about, is, you know, what's actually happening on the ground. Not, like you said, not these.
I don't know if this is going to sound pretentious, but anyway, but was it the bubonic plague? I don't know. The writer Michel Foucault wrote about how they had to construct these immense kind of structures to contain the plague, right? Yeah. And then once the plague had gone, they were left with these structures. And what I have in my mind, because I don't know if either of you have really been up to what's called the security wall, which is actually like a 30-foot, 4-meter concrete. This is not a fence. This is a fucking tsunami of concrete coming at you at a million miles an hour, right? That's what it feels like. And what they have done is they have invented the plague by constructing by making the construction, if you know what I mean. And this is the tragedy, and this is the difference between apartheid South Africa and apartheid Israel, is that South Africa was so much more hopeful because despite the laws that forbade us from making love or writing plays together or hanging out together, you know, or living together, we were mixed together just because, you know, there were cities and there was like sensuality and attraction built into that kind of othering, right? Whereas for my nieces and nephews who have never met a Palestinian because they are behind a 30-foot concrete, like, I don't know, 700-kilometer long, what is it? I mean, I don't know how to describe this thing. On the other side of that is your worst possible projection of an enemy that your imagination can possibly conjure up. There's nothing, there's no desire, there's no attraction, there's no compulsion to, there's no curiosity.
No.
And it's and you know, the point is as a foreigner, it's so easy to go through the checkpoints. You just drive through, right? And like, I mean, you know, you know the musician Nicholas Yar, you know, he's like, his dad is an old friend, Alfredo Yar, who's an artist friend who I always thought was Chilean, but actually is originally Palestinian. And Nicholas has gone back there and he's running workshops every week in Bethlehem. And it's like, there's a great scene there. There's a great, I mean, and this is the other thing, is this generation of Palestinians, Talal, you spoke about these moments of hope, you know, that have risen. And you spoke about, Alexa, you spoke about the beginnings of BDS. This is a different moment. We've got a generation now who are like, first of all, they have, some of them are incredibly privileged, have had Ivy League educations, are in touch with intersectional solidarity things. So when people talk about indigenous rights or Black Lives Matter or LGBTQI, you have to talk about Palestine, right?
Yes.
And also, they're fucking sexy. I mean, you've got Bella Hadid, right?
Yeah.
And they
Jenna Ortega.
And they like... Yeah, man. So it's like, you know, there's no longer, and I'm going to say this word, it's no longer the dirty Arab.
Yeah.
You know, no. It's the sexiest, fucking smartest person you have ever encountered.
Yeah.
And that's why they fight so hard to, defend, you know, to sully that.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry to be so heavy. This is so heavy.
No, not at all. I think
we needed this after last.
What the fuck
last episode.
You got extra? Yeah.
Not that the last episode was different. We talked about Palestine last week as well, but I wanted to go deeper into it. I was. That's why I was pushing for this chat here.
I think you make me feel very inadequate.
Inadequate? I need your help and you need mine, and that's what we need to do, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to say one thing because Talal told me that you're a Bertolt Brecht fan.
Yes.
So the first thing is to say that I've spent the better portion of months, you know, the Brecht Benjamin archive is held in, is in Brecht's former apartment in Berlin. Have you ever been there?
No.
Yeah. Well, this is a formal invitation to come because I know the curator, and you can just spend hours in there alone going through his wardrobe. I don't know if that turns you on.
Yeah. It never occurred to me, but yeah.
but I've made these two pieces of work. One is, you know, he made this book called Kriegsfiebel, which was his kind of he took cuttings from the newspaper during the Second World War, and he wrote these short poems underneath, which to kind of decode the language of photojournalism. And what we did is it was during the war, the so-called War on Terror, right? You know, that period of time. and we took, you know,
crazy days.
Yeah. But so we superimposed images of those over his. We actually, like, we got the last 100 copies of his, of the English publication of Kriegswiebel, and
which translates made to these
books. I'll get one sent to you.
What's the translated war?
War primer, as in like a textbook.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yours was called the War Primer 2.
That's it. Yeah. And then one more story, which is that the last three pictures, certainly of Walter Benjamin, because during the war, Brecht was offered like a cottage somewhere in Scandinavia, in exile, and there are these three pictures of him and Walter Benjamin under a fig tree playing chess.
Right.
And you see the chessboard and you see the as it progresses, but nobody knows the outcome of that game, right? So I was saying to Talal that the Chinese invented this kind of chessboard that you can play. It's a computer, so you can play against it, but it physically moves the pieces with like magnets underneath, right?
Right.
But what we did is we encoded it with an algorithm that it always started with the same setup of the last picture. And played ad infinitum every possible incarnation of that game because nobody knows who would have won it.
Right. Mm.
But I do have some bad news for you, which is underneath Brecht's leather jacket was he always wore a silk shirt and you know he had a credit card to his Swiss bank account. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
Yeah, no, I think he was a rogue. I mean, he was not, you know, he's not admirable in many, many ways, I think, really. but that's one of the things that's attractive about him. I think.
Me too.
Yeah. He's not a noble character at all.
Really. No, and a bully, like when you compare him to Walter Benjamin, he bullied him, but... I'm a bit more of a Brecht than a Jesus. Listen to me. I sound like a pretentious fucking. Cut that out, will you?
No. Finish it. You're a bit more of a Brecht than a what? Than a who? Than a Woody Allen?
Oh fuck that! I mean, I'm actually comparing myself. Like, dare to say something like that? Christ, man.
I thought you would enjoy that surprise Brecht connection, Alexei.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I noticed your handle or whatever is Mother Courage. That's your.
I did that on purpose for you.
Oh, right. Oh, thank you.
Also, there are these books available, but you must. I don't know if you ever come here, but
I've only been once actually. You're making me the only other person I know in. I haven't seen him for years in Berlin, his double Oscar winner, Christoph Waltz, of course.
Well, if you do come, I will. That is full title. I know the curator of this of this place well, and I think you'd love it.
Yeah, no, I would love to come. I think we'll.
We could do a trip, Alexei. We could do a video log.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I don't know. I like knowing people in other cities, and I know very few people in very few other cities, really. So now I'd love to come there.
I was fucking terrified to meet you now because, you know, I didn't grow up in England, and I told a couple of people, I told the mother of my kids, you know, I was doing this thing, and you know, she grew up there, and she was like, Jesus fuck, like Alexei, it's like. And then I like looked up this YouTube and it was like, I'm fucking from Liverpool. I grew up in a cottage thing. You know, we lived off the proceeds of selling my fucking foreskin. And who the fuck are you? And that's what I was like expecting this. I said to Talal, can you put it like a one of those date rape things in his coffee? Because. I'm very relieved that you're...
No, I'm not that guy. I never was, really. That was always a... Right. It was always a complication, really, in my...
Wow.
I wasn't, I'm caricature. Not my persona, really.
You know, I did this post last night on Lenny Bruce. Did you ever see that photograph of Lenny Bruce holding up the newspaper and it says, 6 million Jews found alive in Argentina?
No, I've never seen
it. And underneath this post, I wrote something, and I really meant this. I said, you know what's happening with weaponizing the term anti-Semitism is what it's flattening out what it means to be Jewish, right?
Yes.
Because I said, I'm a proud Jew. If I had to identify as anything, it would be Jewish, right? But I have minimal relationship with the State of Israel. I have no relationship with the Hebrew language. I have no relationship with the Orthodox religious practices, but Jesus, do I have a Jewish identity? And that humor that I started speaking about, the kind of Yiddishkeit, which is like Jewishness, that Larry David humor, where that, did you ever see the one where he goes to the Palestinian chicken place and and she's like, the waitress is like, fuck me like your people fuck my country. but that's Jewish identity. And you're stealing it from me, you flat bastards.
Yeah, yeah. You're just one kind of saintly peace loving. Yeah.
Like the monolith of the victim, you know, it's like.
Yeah. Thank you. I think, Adam, that was, I think that's an amazing story, really. We don't think we've covered half of it, but.
Listeners, please, if you want to see any of the videos that Adam's been talking about and you've not already followed him, he's on, I think your most prolific output is on Instagram, in terms of social media anyway. It's just at Adam Broomberg, isn't it? Adam Broomberg with an E. In the Berg part of Broomberg. Go follow him. Check out some of these videos that he mentioned. I think, that video of those kids attacking you is on there, right? I saw that, didn't I?
Well, I don't go back there to re-traumatize myself.
I'm sorry.
thank you really both for your time. I'm honestly, at a time like this, to be given a chance to tell my story is really valuable. I'm very grateful, honestly.
It's nothing at all. It's really
keep us posted with how it works out, man. And we
yeah, I will.
What a
I will.
fucking a miserable fucking shitbag. You know, the whole fucking
thing. Well, I might have to move closer to you than you think.
Yeah, welcome, and yeah. But yeah, I'd love to come to Berlin. We should do it. We're going. We've not been anywhere. We've not been hardly anywhere since sort of lockdown. Really, we've lost the habit of traveling.
Like, Berlin's
I love it. I've been to Berlin once. I'd loved it.
Well, especially with your like Marxist. Yeah. Like, this place will fascinate you like crazy.
Yeah. We didn't. You know, we just came for a few days, and really only scratched the surface.
It'd be great to get the Broomberg tour.
I'd love to, Berlin.
I'll arrange a whole itinerary. And then we can go to Hebron as well another time.
Well, that's, yes.
Oh, you spoke last time about your worries about going to visiting Palestine.
Yeah.
You had three reasons.
One was I thought that I might, you know, because elderly Jews, that they can suddenly flip and go all kind of Zionistical, really, you know, as you're approaching the kind of prospect of your own mortality, suddenly somebody who's all like BDS and hip and like pro-Palestinian, and you go and see him again a week later and they've gone all kind of rabbinical on you. So I'm a bit worried about that. I'm also, as a fan of weaponry and also the thought of young women with M4 carbines. very complex reaction of the combination of a beautiful young woman and an assault rifle it might be too much for me. I don't know how something very unpleasant would happen there. Something tremendously repellent would happen. I can't remember what the third one was. Oh, they wouldn't let me in.
They wouldn't let you in.
They'll let you in.
They're really
a person of note.
Oh, yeah.
So, good luck, Adam. I hope it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Gets better. And thank you very much for doing this. And I think we'll get a fantastic response. I hope this will be one of our most important videos ever. All right.
All right. Bye, Alexi.
Bye-bye.
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 Right. Did I do good, Alexi? Was that a good guess?
You did, yes. I did think he was a family friend for some reason, but
our family do tend to know everyone, but no, not this person.
I like this direction we're going in, really. It's fucking hell. They really do make you pay, don't they, if you want to stick your head above the parapet, though, they're making it harder. You know, they're making it harder and harder. Really,
this and like he's not even like a major celebrity or he's got like a big financial security. He's like a honest, hardworking family man and teacher and an artist, and it goes to that kind of state level of accusation and discourse.
Yeah.
Potentially has the potential to ruin someone's life completely.
Yep. Oh, yes.
And depending on how he behaves in the next few weeks, it will.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to follow that story, really.
Yeah. He's very vocal and open about all of his progress on his Instagram and on Twitter. So, Adam Broomberg, look him up, guys.
Say all that again.
Follow Adam Broomberg. I think that was it. Yeah, find Adam Broomberg on Instagram, on Twitter, and he does share his progress, his personal life, and his incredible documentation of his trips out there and stuff. He's a fascinating guy, and I'm really honored and happy he came on the show.
Yeah, I'm gonna go and visit him in Berlin, but probably not next week.
Not in the next couple of weeks.
Give it a while.
Mate, if we could take our GoPros out there and do a little travelogue of a trip to Berlin. Because there is a Marxist history there. We could rent a couple of bikes. Yeah, there's entrenched Marxist history there and Brecht, lots of Brecht stuff going on, and all the cool, kinky, sexy stuff too. We'd have a great time out there, Alexi.
Yeah, and he's not that young anymore. I've got a friend who's a DJ in Berlin as well. He lives in Berlin and he DJs. DJ Alex Blanco, he's quite old. He's getting older now, but he's a DJ, and I'm sure he DJs in the clubs in Kreuzberg. I'm sure he DJs.
Wow,
and
that
is my German accent. I think it is not too bad. I'm not very good at accents.
It's a decent attempt at a German accent, but
you think it is? I think it is a decent attempt at a German accent, and it's like I'm very much into DJ. I'm a DJ,
what's your handle? What name do you go by?
My handle is DJ Squawky Cat.
Oh, Squawky Cat, of course I heard your music in the sex clubs in the fourth quarter. I am, of course, my name is DJ Ubermansch.
I'm friends with many DJs. I'm friends with Thoroughfare and I'm friends with Plantpot. He's a very good friend of mine. And
have you heard the wonderful spinnings of DJ Fantastisch Leatherstrap?
Fantastic leather strap. Yes, I think he's mediocre leather strap myself. I'm not a tremendous fan, but I follow a microphone on Instagram.
Microphone. He uses only his own body to make the music.
I like very much Stepladder. She's great. Mm. Yeah.
Stepladder is on a higher platform. Yeah. See you at 10 p.m. for the beginning.
See you at 10 p.m. for a beer at club. I'm looking at things in my room here.
Club Thermostat, club, you know. Of course. Come on.
Club Metal Tray.
Club Wilf.
Yeah, Club Wilf. This is the best club. I love Club Wilf.
Wilf is a German name. Is it not?
Can be a German name, but sometimes it is not Wilf. So yeah, Wilf. It is sometimes.
I was thinking of Wolfgang.
Where is Wolfgang? This is completely.
Yes, yeah, I was confused. I've taken so many amphetamines this morning.
I'm so crazy, man.
How crazy to be alive.
I'm wearing nothing but leather underpants.
Oh, I'm wearing nothing but olive oil. Coated head to toe.
Should we do the Patreon? Could we mention something?
Yeah, have you heard of this thing? Patreon.com/Alex. Yes, you want to say it the same time as I. It's so exciting to say the words.
You say it. Okay, you say it first. That's it.
You will say it after me, and we do like a tandem plugging of Patreon. Okay, fantastic. Patreon.com/AlexisHell podcast.
Patreon.com/AlexisHell podcast.
Oh, it feels so good coming out the lips.
Oh, you're making me crazy.
Oh, clicking on this website brings such joy to every essence of my being.
Oh, this is so good. So good.
You go there, you subscribe, you click button, put in card details. And for any amount of monthly payment, you can get access to so many lovely, a handful of lovely Alexi goodies.
Special elements.
And more to come, so much more to come. And you'll also be supporting this fantastic cause of the Alexis Hell podcast.
And I'm going to, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to Amsterdam, and then I will do my Dutch accent. I might do it now. Hop aboard, only 15 guilders. I am Ten Hag, and I like the dribbles. The dribbles. Do you like the dribbles of Manchester United? The dribbles of Marcus Rashford? The dribbles. Hop aboard my tram.
Oh, you are so aggressive. It's a bit unnerving for a tender Berlin personality like myself.
I think this has gone crazy now.
Yes, maybe not.
But I'm going to stay in this accent. Maybe today I will live my life in this accent. And years ago, I remember I was I taught drama at the London College of Printing, and to a printing apprentices. And as an exercise once, I went with only one of my printing apprentices, and we went around London getting drunk and talking just like this.
Oh,
it was highly inappropriate, the behavior of me as a college lecturer, but there's a student that I was friendly with, and we went out for a drink, and we stayed. This has just come back to me now. This is a memory, a deeply buried memory that we did all night. We pretended to be German, the two of us.
Just two of you?
Yes.
Not the whole class.
It was highly inappropriate. It was all wrong, completely wrong. But he was my student, and he was... we pretended. I'd forgotten that, but we stayed in character all night, I think, as two Germans. Yeah. So, I don't know where I'm from, but maybe I'm from Dusseldorf.
I cannot do a Dutch accent, so I will not
Dusseldorf
try.
Is in Germany.
Oh, Dusseldorf. But it's I thought you switched to Dutch Germany. And now you're back to German again.
No, okay. I don't know how much of this will be usable.
Oh, very little. Let's end it now then.
All right. Auf Wiedersehen, everybody.
Auf Wiedersehen. Dankeschön. Alles gut, alles klar, alles wunderbar.
You've been listening to the Alexis Hell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.